Hello, and welcome to Millennial 2017 number 12, and this is with No White Guilt. Now, I first became aware of No White Guilt shortly after the now infamous Skeptic stream, the Warsky stream, which was basically a sort of condemnation, a group condemnation of Rage After Storm. And you made a really good and very entertaining video. I think it was about 30, the stream was, I think, about 2 hours long. You made a 35-minute response video to it. And you went through the various things that they said and dispelled each one and disproved each one. And it was very effective and, as I say, very entertaining. So from that point on, I followed you. And then you semi-migrated to BitChute once we started getting concerned about post-Charlottesville censorship on YouTube. I think you're now putting whole videos back on YouTube, but we can talk about that later. So hello, No White Guilt, welcome to the channel.
Hello, Woz, and thank you for bringing me into the conversation. Before we actually get rolling, I would like to thank you for your service to our people. Too often, there are folks like us who dedicate our lives and put our names and our faces on the line, and we don't receive thanks for that, and especially public thanks. So I would like to extend that thanks to you for your service to our people. And I would like to say to the listeners who are live and those who will listen in this show in the coming weeks and months, that I ask you to show your appreciation to Woz by putting some food in his belly. I mean, you can't slap him on the back. You can't shake his hand. You can say way to go, but that is not going to sustain him. So make a small contribution, put some food in his belly, and thereby show your appreciation for the work, the dedication, especially for not just his work throughout the year, but also here at the end of the year when he conducts this millennial, bringing everybody together and spreading the message.
Well, thank you very much. That's very kind of you to say that. I mean, we all make sacrifices. Anyone who puts themselves out there. I never, to be fair, you know, to be accurate, I didn't put my name out there. That was done against my will, although I did suspect that it would happen eventually. But yeah, since, right. Yeah, I mean, it is a very strange life that you end up living in this movement if you go for it full throttle, and I did. Of course, if I'd been given the choice, if you'd told me what it was going to be like 4 years ago, I don't know what I would have done. But that's another matter. Some people go into it with their eyes open. You know, they know what it's they have an inkling of what it's going to actually entail. And I think those people are really due the fullest appreciation and praise.
Well, you have not shirked your duty. I mean, since you were doxxed, you stayed strong, and you deserve thanks for that. You deserve thanks for all of the work you're doing. And I don't know how many times that people have given you that thanks, but thank you. I went into it very early in my life, knowing, I guess, seeing what the teachers were doing at school around the age of 12. And I was in an extremely anti-white environment, and I fought back orally and physically in some cases with anti-whites of various races. And it's been that way for me ever since. I began joining organizations, scores of them, since I got started when I was 18. And so it's rare that we're ever thanked. We incur a lot of hatred and animosity and threats and the like, but rare that we're ever appreciated.
Yeah, I think that it sounds like, you see, most white people today, well, most white people of our generation, I think you're about 30, we grew up in an environment that was basically white or at least safe for white people. It sounds like you actually grew up in an environment that was not safe for white people. So you had to adapt to this earlier than most of us did. Would that be true?
Yeah, without question. I went from a benign elementary school, which in America, you're looking at kindergarten to roughly sixth grade, to a junior high school outside of the nation's capital, seventh and eighth grade. So 12, 11, 12, 13 years of age, that was rabidly anti-white, that had a commons area that had an enormous, far larger than life. I mean, I think about maybe 8 feet tall and maybe 6 feet wide. It was made out of paper, but it was like a portrait of Martin Luther King that overlooked the commons area. And so there was the physical threat by the anti-white non-whites in the student body, and then the threat that came by from the teachers and the administration. So it was relentless.
That sounds just appalling. I mean, at what age did you first consciously become aware of it? Was it like when you first went to that middle school?
Well, I guess I could say that I was semi-lucky or unlucky. When I went to preschool at a non-denominational Christian preschool, my first encounter, and of course I didn't know that this was what I would later call anti-white ideology, anti-whiteism, was in one of my classes where they had brought in a giant flip chart, and they were showing us illustrations of good and bad behavior. And it was kind of large cartoon characters of children, and the students or the children that were behaving bad were all white little boys that looked pretty much like me. And the victims were all non-white children. So it was like the boy that was pushing in the image was a white little boy. The boy or girl being pushed was black. And then the boy that was pulling hair was white little boy, looked kind of like me. The girl getting her hair pulled was like an Asian girl. And so I just noticed that I was kind of being singled out. And noticing that caused me to notice the singling out of our people in the Christian songs. And then I noticed the singling out on the radio, on the cartoons at home, in our other studies. And I didn't know at that time, I didn't have any way to appreciate what was happening in Western civilization. I could just identify that me and my kind were being singled out as the bad ones. When I reached junior high school, the anti-white ideology was taken up a notch. And so we were specifically named and identified as the bad guys. And I innocently began questioning this. Why is it that we are always the bad guys? Why is it that the only whites that are the good guys in these tales, that they are anti-white? And concurrently, I asked, why is it that non-white people and non-white cultures are celebrated and that we are not permitted to celebrate ourselves? And that...
Sorry, before you go on, did you actually like verbally ask those questions to any adults, or were they just in your head?
No, I asked those questions. And that's how I ended up getting into as much difficulties as I did. I began asking them, the responses that I received from the adults were things like, well, whites, if they have pride, if they show pride in their culture, it leads to things like the Ku Klux Klan, and it leads to things like Nazi Germany. So we don't want to think those things. It just is this way. And from the student body, you know, as a seventh grader, the difference between a seventh grader and an eighth grader maturity level, especially between a white seventh grader and a non-white eighth grader, is significant. So there was a lot of, and we had, you know, non-whites bust into our area from more violent areas. So there was an immense physical threat. And at this school that was run by leftist administrators, they had taken a lenient approach to fighting. We weren't suspended when we fought. We were just sent to our classes. So there were bloody fights where kids would be broken up and then just sent on their way. And if you regularly fought, you would get detention, and that would mean having to stay after school, which nobody wanted to do. But rarely was anybody ever suspended or certainly expelled for fighting from that school. And it still has a reputation that lingers in the area from that time period.
Sorry, I was just reading the chat. So the one other thing that occurred to me when you said that that your culture was undermined, your people, white people, but also white culture, was that even defined? I mean, what it is to be a white American?
Well, I think for me, being a Virginian and therefore identifying as a Virginian and a Southerner, everything that it means, I think at least in this part of the South now, are you from Scotland? Is that where you were?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So there's a pretty big difference in the South between, I don't know what the South is perceived like in Scotland or other parts of the world, but you have like the deep South, and then
I'll tell you that from my perspective, people's image of the South is largely filtered through, there's no other way to say it, it's largely filtered through Jewish Hollywood, so that the South is redneck, ignorant, stupid, hateful, violent, aggressive, white people, uneducated white people. Right. There might be some cutesy, you know, like someone playing the fiddle, that kind of thing, and the Southern drawl, but the substance of it is basically low grade and hateful. That's the image. I mean, if you were to say the American South to a lot of people, that's basically, I think in Britain, that's basically what they would think. They would think, well, obviously cowboys and that kind of stuff, but fundamentally, their image of it today is what I just described, I think.
Right. Well, it's clearly that's anti-white propaganda, and that's something we can talk about a little later, and that's intentional, that anti-white propaganda. What I wanted to say about the South, when I say that I identify as a Southerner, is that if you have been to the United States and you have traveled through the South, you'll see that the South has a varied culture. There are a lot of norms, but to be a Southerner in Alabama is a little different than being a Southerner in Virginia.
That's exactly the sort of thing that outside of America is not so well known. Obviously Washington and Oregon are adjacent, contiguous, but they do have different cultures. That sort of thing is not so easily transmitted to outside of America.
Right. Well, so I identified as a Southerner, white Southerner, and to be a Southerner, to a real Southerner, means white. It doesn't mean, you know, back in the day, I think the term for it had nothing to do with homosexuality, but it was rainbow Confederate. And what that meant was that to be a Southerner or the Southern culture meant many different races. And it's just the sort of nonsense that we hear today. So I identified as a white American, a white Southerner, and that was besmirched severely. I mean, like our greatest heroes, like we were fighting. I went to the Charlottesville rally this past year. Robert E. Lee was one of my heroes growing up, and he was absolutely traduced and dragged through the mud at my junior high. And to a degree, so was people like, or so were people like Tom Jefferson, even Washington, because these people owned slaves. And Thomas Jefferson, well, maybe he even raped slaves. So that was the type of environment that I was in. That was my culture, that I was seeing the white culture being attacked and not permitted to, you know, we weren't permitted to celebrate any of it. I mean,
this is amazing. This is what you hear about happening nowadays in America, but I didn't realize it was actually going on 20 years ago.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, I think when we think about anything, generally speaking, to wrap our minds around it, we think of it as an entity, a single thing, even, you know, a movement or a concept or what's happening in a certain area, when in reality, it is an immensely complex phenomenon. And there are surges and laggards and clearly in Virginia, outside of Washington, D.C., we were ahead maybe of the curve when it came to brainwashing and white guilting the white children. And that's probably, and that's, I, by the way, and we can talk about, or maybe just mention it later, that I do have a book coming out on January 1st, and then another on March, I hope, of this coming year. And that really what it is child abuse. This is this anti-white ideology that is inflicted on white children is child abuse. It's physical, mental, and spiritual child abuse. And as a consequence, we grow and never know who we are. We never realize our potentials as a consequence because we are infected with, I call them meme pathogens, so MPs for short. But we are infected with these ideas. Its own example is a diversity is our strength. That's a meme pathogen. Or we are a nation of immigrants. That's another one. That they infect us with these notions. So it causes us to not be able to make the best decisions, logical decisions. I mean, it puts us into a physical, mental, and spiritual sickness. And when we look to our elders, we look to our friends, and we try to claw our way out of this sickness, we find no relief because they are suffering from the exact same illness.
Yeah, they're all equally deracinated.
Yeah, precisely. And I guess the kind of, I didn't want to get too far off of what you wanted to talk about with the Worski live stream. That was, I don't know how much your listeners, viewers know about that. Essentially, there was Rage After Storm was a skeptic, and then she was courageous enough to follow the truth toward the center of gravity, which is white well-being. And the skeptics decided to cook her alive for doing so. And I didn't know.
Yeah, she was an apostate. She turned against the creed.
Well,
quite amazing to watch.
It really was, and very well said, because that's exactly what happened. I didn't know who she was. I'm not a big YouTuber, if you will. I kind of just dip my toe into this for the purpose of communicating some of my ideas to people who want to learn to better defend themselves against anti-white ideology. And so I had just checked in. This video had popped up for me, this Worski live stream, and I watched it, and I couldn't believe the behavior of these snarky, revolting little creatures and how they were treating this female who was simply seeking the truth and coming to a conclusion that white well-being was okay, that we didn't have to reject white well-being.
Yeah, I did a video at the time, mostly inspired by that stream and the subsequent actions against Rage After Storm on Twitter, when Kraut and T, he sort of tried to sabotage her life in other ways by telling some organization, it wasn't her employer, it was an organization that she worked for, pointing them to her activities and so on. My video was really about the stream and what it said about that community. This is the skeptic community, which I'm not even that sure about its origins. I've heard that it originated as the atheism, like the new atheism movement with, you know, Christopher Hitchens and what's his name? I've forgotten his name. Dawkins something. What is his name? I've forgotten his first name, but anyway, that era from the late 2000s, and then became the anti-SJW thing in the sort of 2013 to 2016. And then in 2017, they were without a foe. They were without an enemy. So they've hit upon the alt-right. And I think that this was sort of handed to them because of Rage After Storm. You know, because someone within their own community basically turned to the alt-right. I can't remember exactly how explicit she made it at the end of her video. I think she actually said that she was a... Did she say she was a white nationalist? Or have I Am I remembering that wrongly? Either way, she was talking about race realism. She was getting into race realism. And she was doing so, as you said, because her curiosity took her there. And you would think, you know, it was scientific curiosity. Now you can argue with her level of knowledge of the subject. It doesn't really matter. The fact is that it was scientific data and that interest in scientific data which took her to that place. Now you would think that a community like this, that call themselves skeptical, would be interested in that, but not at all. They're actually very ideological, and when somebody turned against their ideology, when their ideology is basically egalitarianism and dope smoking, you know, it's just it's just a sort of detached faux intellectual superiority. And when somebody turned against that onto something that was actually serious and which threatened their egalitarianism, they were outraged. And another thing about them, which I went into in one of the previous millennials a day ago, is that I think they have this attitude that everything is just fine and life is a joke, life's a laugh. When somebody goes into something serious, they don't know how to handle it. And they react by attacking the person. It was remarkable to see. And of course, you have more knowledge about the science of racial differences than I do. So I imagine that for you to watch that stream was just an ordeal.
Oh, it was excruciating because they're the typical pseudo-intellectual, snarky, inane, cherry-picking twits. I mean, that's really what it was. And they were together, and the whole purpose was to lambaste her, to mock her, to laugh at her. And that's what they were doing. And everything they were saying was perfectly outrageous and easily trumped. So I decided to make that video. It wasn't about... there were a few people, not many, who claimed that I was white knighting for her. But in reality, I was just destroying anti-white pigs. And that was my
intent. Yeah, there is that. They were doing something that was unjust. If they'd done it to a male 19-year-old, it would also have been bad. It was the dishonesty of it that just... It infuriated me.
Oh yeah, everything that they were saying was absolutely dishonest. I mean, and as I pointed out in the video, I think Kraut, he was there, and I don't know if it's still the case for them. I can't imagine it is, but he was their in-house intellectual. That's how he was billed. That's how he was introduced.
Yeah.
I think the guy who was Andy was his name, and Chris, and they billed him as the brilliant, you know, descending from on high, from his ivory tower, to render his judgment.
Yeah, and easily trouncing this silly girl, this traitor.
Right.
You know, he with his incredible intelligence, just easily destroyed everything she'd said.
Right.
You know, and nothing could be farther from the truth. This is the irony of with Kraut and T. He is intelligent, but he's also lazy and incredibly egotistical. And that's really what you were seeing, well, with that stream, but then especially with his behavior after that stream. And then it goes on, you know, because then I made my video countering it, and yours as well, of course. And then he went on a crusade against the alt-right, which he seems to still be on. First with race realism, which he made four terrible videos about that. And now he's apparently moving on to the Holocaust.
Oh, is he?
So, okay. Yeah, that's what I heard. I don't know if it's true. But the thing is, his four videos against the alt-right on race realism were just laughable. They were appalling. and he'd obviously put effort into them, but he was just wrong. He does not have the... level of academic knowledge that one needs in order to legitimately combat race realism. He doesn't have that level of knowledge. But I don't want to get too much into the skeptic thing unless you want to talk more about it. But I think I would. There's a lot more to be said. I mean, they are just an abscess on our world, as far as I'm concerned.
They are, and yeah, I'm fine. We've said enough about them.
So then I suppose we could get into back to your story. You obviously were at high school, and then what happened beyond that? Did you continue to see the what you call anti-white or anti-white rhetoric and culture developing? Or were there any points along the way where you realized that you were right about this? Or did you, was it gradual?
Oh, I knew probably in seventh grade, once I began to question in this junior high school, roughly 1,000 or so students, to give the listeners a perspective. So it's a large middle high school, so a junior high school just prior to high school in the States. And as soon as I began to question, it was innocent in the beginning, but their reaction demonstrated that their behavior was not innocent. And so I knew that I was up against something, that my people was up against something that I couldn't comprehend, that was so deep in our society, I couldn't understand. And so, but I went to war against it personally. I battled my teachers. I as I say, I physically fought the anti-white non-whites, some anti-white whites as well along the way. And it got worse as I got to high school, and very large there. Several thousand students in the high school. But it was after high school, I guess it was my senior year, that I began joining organizations that I felt that either directly or indirectly were serving white well-being, because for me, that's what mattered. And to this day, I support every endeavor for white well-being that accords with my morality. So I was joining organizations that were specifically about historical preservation. That was what they focused on. And then that branched into, I guess, simultaneously into the preservation of Southern identity and the like. And so since then, I have been a participant. I've been a follower. I've been a leader. I've been the guy who passes out leaflets at the mall, who pins up leaflets on the cork boards at grocery stores, who drives around and throws the newspapers into people's front driveways. You know, I started off at that, helping many different groups back then. And over the years, I've made a great many contacts. I've developed essentially an intelligence network, if you will. And I help the movement and different causes, as I say, when they are focused on white well-being and they accord with my morality. Sometimes that has been financial assistance, but I'm far from rich, so it has been less financial than in other ways. My contributions, as far as advice is concerned, is prized by many individuals, and so I've helped them when they've sought my help with questions and scenarios that they couldn't resolve. I have, when I've been able, I've provided information through that comes by way of my network to entities and individuals to help facilitate efforts for white well-being, and in cases where I have been able to pull strings behind the scenes, when those strings are within my grasp to pull, I have pulled them so that efforts could come to fruition. And I'm probably proudest of the efforts that I've made that the participants did not know that I enabled their effort to come to fruition. It's sort of like when you contribute at church and you write a big check, a big donation to the church, you're not going to feel as well. I guess if you're a healthy, normal white individual, you're not going to feel as good about it if you walk to the front of the congregation and hold the check up and say, this is how much money I'm giving to the church.
You know, yeah, of course.
You feel best when you write that check. Nobody else knows how much that you've donated and you drop it in the box. And so those are probably some of my proudest moments. But I was doing banner drops and posting imagery on signposts many, many years before there was an identity movement in Europe doing it and this identity movement in the U.S. doing it now. And I'm very happy to see those efforts. But it's been a long road.
It certainly has. This is what I was getting to earlier. For most white people in our movement, it's only now dawning on them what is the situation is. I think that you had a sort of preview of it in where you were growing up. That's how it sounds, anyway. It sounds like it was unusually bad where you were.
Please go ahead.
Well, you can understand why these organizations are emerging now, because it seems to be becoming like all across America, but also in Europe as well, in various European countries, basically every Western European country. It's now becoming much more obvious than it was 20 or 30 years ago that we are being replaced.
Right. And I think that it was back then, and of course, even earlier, it was people who were focused on what was happening were able to look at where we were from where we had come, and then they were able to project to where we were headed. And they were as energetic, I guess, as someone would be today, seeing where we are today. And so back when I was, when I was 18 years old, I was able to project where we were going to be today. And so there was that concern for my people, my culture. And when I say that, my people, my culture, I'm talking about the white race and Western civilization. I refer to us as Western kind. And
yes, I noticed that term in your videos.
Right. I use a couple of terms, and this goes to something that you and I had discussed. I craft positions so that they are inviolable, so that an anti-white has to reveal that they are anti-white to attack the position. And I hold the position just like a strong beachhead. I will maintain that beachhead. And the anti-whites, all they can do is flip around sort of like a fish on the end of a line, attempting to do what they do with everybody else, but unable to do what they do with everybody else, which is to drag them through all of these different sophistical arguments and trash their argument, trash what they're trying to say, and in the end, leave the person who's fighting for white well-being shaking their head and feeling defeated. I just won't allow it. And so that's one of the things that I and my think tank, my intelligence network, that's what we have been discussing and working on for years now. And it's been a position that I have argued for with leaders of different organizations that they should take. And the advice is not always taken. And I think it's to their detriment, because when we fight on the enemy's terms, when we go on their field, we could use like a sports analogy. When we go on their field, we have to play by their rules. And if we have to play by their rules, we can never win. You know, they can change the rules mid-game. And that's what happens in a lot of arguments.
Oh, yeah. You'll start off with one thing and you'll answer that. And then they turn out, well, actually, your answer doesn't matter because I've just shifted the goalposts. This happens constantly, and they feel no shame in doing that. They're not even embarrassed.
Precisely. And there's an even worse behavior. And it's what they do, worse than just shifting the goalpost, is that they will invert reality. And if you have, this is one of the worst things that they do. I have no doubt whatsoever that there are highly educated, intelligent, anti-white individuals working for very wealthy anti-white individuals that come up with such tactics to defeat us in argumentation because they know that that we're right.
So yeah, this has been built up over decades.
You know, precisely.
The mechanisms, the sort of argumentational mechanisms are taught to the young, not only at university, but even in high school now. So the idea, for example, that it's impossible for white people to be the victims of racism because racism has to include power. So it's racism. What is it? Hatred plus power equals whatever it is. Well, right. I mean, that is, I'm not even, what would you say to that, actually? What would you say to that?
Well, what would I say to if somebody were to say that racism is, and then they provide another definition?
Yeah, prejudice plus power.
Well, it would depend on the scenario, where that conversation was coming from, what kind of person I was talking to, if it were, you know, a face-to-face conversation. But basically, the use of the word racism identifies the user as anti-white. And that's something that everybody that's listening should empower themselves with.
Is that right, that's exactly what I was hoping for with this hangout. Because that's interesting, because I was thinking, well, I would say that racism doesn't just include power, you know, or societal power, and also in micro situations, the individual black person might have more power than the white, so on. But you've just gone straight to the end and said they're only saying this because they're anti-white in the first place.
Right. Well, the word racist, the concept racist, is a weaponized word, a weaponized term for social control. And it is meant to demonize the act of working for white well-being. So if you have demonized the act to work for white well-being, you're saying that the opposite is good. The opposite being working for white ill-being. And so the only kind of person who would take that position and make that argument is an anti-white person. And so the purpose is to push them back on their heels and to force them to defend themselves. And if you look in my conversations, and sometimes I will take these anti-whites on the threads under my videos for the purpose of demonstrating the argumentation tactics that I use against them that are eminently successful so that others can see and pick them up. And I've had others write me, and it's very gratifying, and say, I've used this, that, and the other thing that you used on this other person, and it worked beautifully in my scenario. The person couldn't respond to what I had to say. So
one possible idea, I don't want to be imposing here, but one possible idea is I have an Ask FM page, and maybe if you set up an Ask FM page, then people could ask you what to say when someone says this, and then you could make a reply video about that statement, just showing how to neutralize it.
I actually have an Ask FM, and I will happily answer any questions, make videos. I had one recently, actually, about the American Indian and our relationship with the American Indian, and I answered that with a video, how to handle that scenario.
That's great. I didn't know you had an Ask FM. Yeah. And I find that website very useful. It's under... It doesn't have all the features I'd like, but it's very useful for getting questions from people. And that's great. I hope that people who are listening to this might go and make use of that, and you can inspire you to make some new videos. Because I have to say, just this sounds sycophantic, but I really do look forward to each one of your videos because they're always nice and short and concise and sort of powerful, you know, punchy. And as I said, I love that you've worked out ways of just neutralizing arguments.
I appreciate you saying that. It means a lot coming from you. Thank you very much, Woves. Yeah, my purpose, I guess, because I really started fighting when I was in seventh grade. When I turned 12 years old, I adopted a mission for my life, and I didn't know how I was going to accomplish it, but the mission was that I was going to free my people of what I now call white noir, and that's sort of the malaise, the sickness that's brought about by all of these anti-white infections. I was going to free them of that so that the powerful Western spirit that is within them would be released. Because if I could free them of that, then there would be nothing that could stop our people. Because that is the spirit that is responsible for our greatest, you know, scientific feats, our feats of medicine, our feats in military might, our feat. It's endless. You know, the stories of whites fighting, physically fighting 8, 9, 10 non-whites who had invaded Europe. You know, we have these stories, and they would fight and defeat 10 individuals. You know, the individuals who, the whites who stayed up without sleep for weeks at a time to answer the riddles of our universe and have supplied us consequently with a standard of living that is vastly beyond what we have seen developed outside of the Western world. That spirit resides in every single one of us. And the closer we come to aligning with that spirit, releasing that spirit, the more likely we are to manifest the abilities that that spirit can manifest. And so, in fact, well, what I would say, though, is back in seventh grade, when all of my buddies were falling in love with girls, I'll just say, I mean, this is in one of my books, because I took the position of defending our people, I was shunned vigorously by white girls. And as a consequence, I think I fell deeply in love with the cause for our well-being. And that's why I adopted that mission for my life. And that's why I've been at it for this entire time. And I can tell you, if you have ever felt rootless or betrayed by society, there is nothing more fulfilling, just physically and spiritually fulfilling, than giving your life to our well-being. It will never betray you. It can only reward you. And it has for my entire life. When everything else waxes and wanes and vacillates in life, even, you know, lovers come and go, and people you can fall in love with, you can remain with, but fall out of love with, but the cause never changes. And so that's what I wanted to say about that. But that story, I mean, I heard you begin to speak when I mentioned how the young white girls rejected me. It was a very painful period, but it's also an inspiring story, because in the end, I am victorious, and I won't give away the end because it is in one of my books, but everybody who knows the story finds it to be very inspiring. And they were the impetus, those who have heard the story, for me including it in one of my books.
Right. It would be good if you could provide links for me to include in the description to your books.
Well, I don't have anything up yet. The first book that will be available, the first of January 2018, is called Go Free. It's a guide. The full title is Go Free, A Guide to Aligning with the Archetype of Western Kind. And essentially with that, you are taught. Now, I've had what many consider an uncanny ability to change the minds and persuade friends and family and bring them to the cause of white well-being, whereas many of us find that very difficult and we go down in flames. I have a lot of success, and I developed over the years a model of how to do that, and the model is in the book. And the most important thing, though, is that the information in the book helps you to go free of these infections, these what I call meme pathogens. And as you go free, you're cleansed. You are able to release. The further you go free, the more you're able to release the powerful Western spirit within you. And so that will be in January, and then probably in March will be the much larger book, which is called Born Guilty. And that is experimental literature. The way it works is you as the reader, you come to visit me at my apartment in the Plains, Virginia, and you stay with me for 2 days. We break bread. You dream. You read several books in my study when I'm not present. One of the books is called Crucible, and that's my period in 7th and 8th grade. Then there's another book called Prometheus Rising, and that's a fictional tale that metaphorically parallels our struggles from as far back as we can look through history. And that's important because we have had a very difficult time coming together as a single people because of how disjointed the history is. We need a single narrative arc to follow, to know where we've been, where we are, and where we can be. And that's what I attempted to provide with that book. It's really mythopoetic, so it's very lyrical. And so some will find that more enjoyable than others. But both of those books are inside of the frame narrative. The authors will know what that term means. That is Born Guilty.
And I that sounds very interesting indeed. Yeah, please do. Well, maybe I could have you on again when each of those books comes out.
Absolutely.
To talk about it. So how much longer do you want to go on? Are you ready to wrap up, or is there anything else you want to talk about?
I feel your pain. I know you've been on all day long. So
no, I'm actually not tired. I'm not tired. It's just I don't want to drag it on longer than it should go on, you know. I think there is a lot to be said and a lot to be explored here. And I think it would probably be better to do it in bits, in each piece individually. Because your story is fascinating, and I find your worldview, more your attitude, very original and interesting. So I think there's probably a lot that you could teach people.
Well,
I know that sounds sycophantic, but it's just the way it strikes me now.
No, I appreciate you saying that. And I don't think it sounds that way at all. You're showing your appreciation, and I have shown mine for your work as well. So there's nothing wrong with that. And yeah,
we're seeing a more human side of you in this, because your videos are so to the point that I think people will not see. Well, certainly your story is very interesting. The history of what you went through as a child is very interesting, because if you have gone into that on your channel, I haven't seen those videos.
No.
I've watched most of your videos.
I have not.
No. This is a different side.
Well, yeah, it certainly is. Not everybody knows it, but it's a story that I do tell in the books, because it will help bring a lot of people to the truth, and will help them to have the courage to stand up and fight. You know, if a little 12 and 13 year old child can stand up against the entire system at his school. Then and incur, by the way, the same allegations that adults incur today. I mean, I was essentially alleged to be desirous of exterminating the non-whites, and I was the thing that was really preposterous was I had grown up with non-white children. I ate at their homes. They ate at my home. I slept over at their houses. They slept over at mine. So when they began making these claims that we just owed them endlessly, especially my black friends that I had slept over at their homes, and they had bigger houses than my parents, had nicer cars. And yet I was being told that they were oppressed and that I owed them. I mean, it was preposterous.
Well, of course, that's the whole thing about white privilege. You can always say, well, what about these working class whites? Are they part of this power network that oppresses these middle class blacks? That just is kind of silly. I mean, even if you were to say, well, but they're associated with the powerful whites. Well, then the powerful whites the white race as a whole is not very cohesive if a large section of it is in a position of weakness.
Well, and precisely.
You can no longer say, well, that they're highly ethnocentric and racist against, xenophobic against other races, when clearly, it just is not the case. And the very fact of white poverty brings that into sharp relief, I think. It just makes it so ridiculous to accuse a poor, like a working class white person of having some kind of institutional power. It's nonsense.
Well, it is nonsense. And also the claim that whites are in power and therefore they have no ground or right to fight for their well-being is preposterous, because the whites who are in power are anti-white. They're not allies.
Yes, indeed. And this is another fallacy that comes up. You know, people will say, well, most of the people I see in power are rich white men. So how are whites being threatened? But yeah, they're being threatened by those very wealthy white people, the elites, who at this stage, look at Angela Merkel.
Right.
There's somebody, I saw this meme the other day. It was Hitler with a bunch of young German kids, and then Merkel with a bunch of young non-German kids who
right.
presumably were destined to have German passports. And of course, it was a very interesting contrast, because you see one leader who loves his people. It doesn't even matter if you have criticisms to make of Hitler. He clearly loved his people. And then you have another leader who's white and is destroying her people actively.
Right.
And shamelessly, without any hesitation at all, without even regrets, without even, and this is really the ultimate insult to white people, without even acknowledging that they exist. I mean, if right. you were to say to Angela, well, what about the German people? If you were to say to Merkel, well, what about the German people? I think she would just say, well, what do you mean?
Right.
Anyone who's in Germany is a German. This is the real insult, I think, that at this stage, we're at the stage where they simply deny our existence.
Yeah, the denying our existence is a sign of anti-white ideology, because they have no problem.
Yes.
And this is the thing I think that people need to appreciate, is that. And this is something I heard some of your discussion. I don't want to go off on your discussion with Sargon, but I heard some of that discussion you had with him. Our people need to appreciate, and when you're having these conversations, that our victimizers, which is what the anti-whites are, our victimizers, their intent is to inflict harm on us as a people, on us as individuals, and on our, what I call our biospiritual manifestation, which in its aggregate is Western civilization. Because if you harm and destroy that which we express and love and need for our survival, that inflicts harm. So their driver, their daily driver, is to inflict harm. Now, eventually, and in the aggregate, that will result in white erasure. But an individual anti-white does not need to plan or think about white erasure to achieve white erasure. When we say things like, well, their goal is to kill off every one of us, it's easy for the opposition to dismiss that as hyperbole, even though that will be the net result. So we can avoid saying that their goal is to exterminate every one of us, for example, and point out that their goal is to inflict harm. That's it. That is what an anti-white's motivation is.
Well, indeed, or simply to say that their activities are anti-white.
Right.
I don't know whether that would hold as much currency as, they're racist, but they're definitely anti-white.
No,
whole attitude, even if it doesn't lead right there and then to the genocide of a white population, it nonetheless paves the way for that and is motivated by an animus towards white people as a collective.
Right. And I write about this in my first book, Go Free, what their motivation really is. And I go on not lengthy. I've tried to make the book as pithy as possible, and but at its very core, the motivating factors for an anti-white, both white and non-white, are jealousy and envy, and then they make of themselves, they perceive themselves as a victim for the disparity. So a non-white doesn't see himself, obviously, as a white person, sees the creations of whites, of the West, our glorious history, and feels jealousy and envy. And then he says, well, there's this disparity, and therefore I'm a victim. And then by calling himself a victim, by concluding that he is a victim, he gives himself the right of self-defense. And that is what he's acting on when he carries out anti-white activities that inflict harm on us. Now, when it comes to a white person, for various reasons, that the white person does not feel him or herself an inheritor of the West's glories. The person might be mentally unwell, might be ugly, might be unfit. There could be a number of reasons. May have had a bad relationship with a parent or parents, but that person does not consider him or herself an inheritor of that glory, and as a consequence, sees the disparity, concludes that he or she is a victim, and then, again, gains the right of self-defense in doing so. Now, in the West, you cannot exact revenge on the grounds of jealousy and envy. And as a consequence, that is where this entire construction of pretexts comes from. So I can inflict harm because whites were evil in the past. And it doesn't matter how illogical the position is. I can inflict harm because whites had slaves. I can inflict harm. It doesn't matter that whites had fewer slaves than others, that blacks sold them the slaves, that everybody else had slaves for longer, that slavery still continues. You know, none of that matters. It's just a pretext. And that's another reason why when you're in an argument with an anti-white, you never address their pretexts, because that's all you'll never get anywhere. It's just a pretext. So in my comment with Sargon, he was saying, well, this is what the social justice warriors, which is really, you know, just a subset of the superset that is anti-white ideology, their motivator is what they say. Well, no, that's not their motivator. You're taking their words at face value. He's like, it felt like, if I could just say, when I was hearing him speak, I felt like I was being transported back to when I was a child and we were playing Dungeons and Dragons. And we had a question about what happens in a given scenario, and we all have to break out the rule books and examine the rule books. And then, okay, there's a consensus. Yes, this is the scenario. These are the rules. And so we're going to abide by them. If you were to corner an SJW, lead them down a dead-end alley based on their principles, they're not going to honorably lose because you've led them down a dead-end alley based on their principles. For principles to them are expedient rationalizations. They will just reinvent the walls of their prison to mean something other than they had meant 2 minutes, 5 minutes earlier, and turn it into a vista, and they will walk right around you. I mean, his prescription would work well as a snarky argument that you might have with an SJW, just to get them to curl their lip at you. But it certainly could not achieve the objective that he was suggesting that it could achieve.
Oh, God, I have no idea how serious he was about that. It's possible that he does think it would work, but it would also benefit him and his movement, the skeptics. Or he thought it would backfire on us and thus kill two birds with one stone. You know, I have no idea, honestly.
Right.
I knew in advance that he was going to present this, but because I had listened to an academic agent stream that he took part in, where he said it would also destroy the alt-right. So I was aware of that in advance, and I was waiting for him to say it. And we'd also had a private chat on Skype a few nights before, and he'd said he was going to present this argument for me. And I said, all right, okay. So, but I don't know how sincere he was, because, yeah, on the one hand, he thinks it would result in the destruction of the alt-right. But on the other hand, he, as he said in the stream with me, it would also it would lead to a white awakening, even if the alt-right itself got destroyed. It would aid white people in survival. But either way, I mean, I just don't think that we need to use those tactics.
Well, it's the point of me bringing it up was to demonstrate that it's a faulty notion. He's taking their pronouncements at face value and then behaving as though their pronouncements are somehow set into a rule book that you can corner them with, and that they will pick up the rule book, have a look, say, well, yep, that's true, I give up then. And that's just simply not going to be the case. They're saying the things they say, which, by the way, they're also for diversity, for diversification of Western civilization. So they would utterly reject moving all of the non-whites out of an area, putting them in another area, just because that would free them of the white boogeyman that harms them. It's an absurd notion. So we should not fall for the same, or should not have the same weaknesses that the skeptics have, which is understanding our opposition, our victimizers, understanding them based on the things they say. Remember, every argument they make is a pretext to conceal their intent to inflict injury on us that's at its core driven by jealousy and envy. So when you address the jealousy and envy and you ignore their pretexts, they lose all power. They have, unfortunately, since the anti-whites control the heights in our civilization, all of our Western countries, the institutions, media, university, they are able to communicate to the masses all of the ways with which to defeat someone who cares about white well-being. So little comments like diversity is our strength and nation of immigrants and this sort of nonsense. We don't have that luxury. So we end up, and by the way, when they invoke such statements, that elicits or triggers the pathogen, the mean pathogen that we are infected with. And that muddies our thoughts. And the subconscious mind, and that's where these things reside after we've imbibed them for year after year of our lives, is infinitely faster than our conscious mind. So by the time we consciously begin to think about what they've just said, we find ourselves having to disagree with ourselves, because subconsciously we're saying, we've heard throughout our lives, and we have not repudiated these things each time we've heard them, and therefore they've seated themselves, that we're a nation of immigrants. And the deeper those things, interestingly enough, the deeper they sit in our subconscious mind, the more power they have over our identity and how we think. So by the time we consciously come to the thought of how do I handle this, we're already in a position to lose the discussion. So, go ahead.
You go ahead. It's okay.
I was just going to say, just to wrap that up, is that we need to both, you know, treat those infections, but in the short term, you know, if you come across them, the listeners, if you come across them, and you want to know how to handle it, is to immediately repudiate the argument as such. Don't debate. Don't, for example, don't say, well, we're generous. You know, if the anti-white says, well, you're not generous enough, that's why you don't want to let them in. Don't begin citing all the ways that we're generous. You know, attack the anti-white on the grounds that they want to change the makeup, the complexion of your civilization. Move the argument to them. Make them to defend why they should, why we should bring in hordes of people, many of them that are stuck almost in prehistoric times with their cultures. Make them defend that. Don't defend yourself. That's it.
I tend to think that a lot of trouble that I run into, and probably a lot of other people run into when they're trying to advocate for white interests, is the people, whoever you're talking to, will say they're coming from the position that if there is such a thing as the white race, it doesn't matter to them. So they are not worried about the gene pool being altered. And so that is a real block for me, because I tend to think that you either care about this or you don't. So I never know what to say to people who don't care about the white race, who don't care that this is all, like, thousands of years of evolution is being thrown down the drain, and you know, all the rest of it. You could put it any way you like. And you can talk about IQ, you can talk about ancestry, culture, our ability to create and empathize, all the rest of it. But if the person you're talking to just doesn't accept that that is, that those are the unique products of a totality, of a singular totality, the white race, they don't accept that, then there's not much that you can say to them, because they can always say, well, how do you know that these things will be obliterated by race mixing? You don't know. And this is a real problem.
Right.
I don't know if you've got anything to say to that.
Well, sure. I mean, this is selling our message. Selling white well-being is like selling any service or product. And there's one thing that a salesman would like to know when he's confronted with a prospect more than anything else in the world. One thing. And the one thing that he wants to know is it certain that this person is not going to buy? So if you knew that when you begin to talk to your prospect, then you know not to waste your time, and you can move on to the next one. So if you come across a white person who really is utterly indifferent to whether we survive or not, and they seem genuine in that, the best thing to do is to move on. That person's not worth wasting another moment on. They're dysfunctional animals. And ultimately, whether you believe that we have spirits or souls or not, we're still part of the animal kingdom. And any animal that would be indifferent to the survival of its own kind is broken. And you shouldn't waste any more time on them. Now, if they are not necessarily broken, if when you speak with them, you can tell that, well, maybe they're saying that because they feel the social pressure of conforming to anti-white ideology, which an anti-white narrative, which dominates our civilization. I would ask about whether or not they would care about a lizard or the black rhino going extinct. Is that fine? And position them with the same question, but relative to other animals in the animal kingdom, and see how indifferent they are about that. And also to position them against the survival of, say, Asians or blacks. Are they indifferent about that? That can be a subtle way of shaming. Now, converting people can be a tricky business. If they are adamant or appear quite adamant, usually a slight amount of demonstrating a bit indifference toward the topic and using questions is the best way to go. I can't remember who said it, but somebody said you can't teach a man anything. He has to find it out for himself. So if you ask questions that are leading, they will arrive at the answers on their own. And that's really how a lot of the propaganda has been waged against us in entertainment, is they lead you in the right direction, and they give you maybe two, no less than two options, because they want to provide the illusion of choice, but sometimes more than two, four or five conclusions that you can arrive at that all serve their interests. And so, you know, when it comes to such a person, you can talk about things. It depends on your knowledge of the different races and history. You know, if they say, well, I'm not, for example, like you said, if they say something like, I'm not so sure that anything will change, I would ask them for evidence that it won't, because we can point to civilizations that were largely or mostly white that have miscegenated with the non-white populations, and those countries have seemingly fallen from grace, or more than seemingly. I mean, we can point to, you know, the genetic history now of places like Egypt, and how Egypt was far whiter when it was in the height of its glory. And now, since it's less white, it's less glorious. And if they're indifferent about that, I mean, another way to take the fight to them in the argument is to point out how shameful it is that they would only be concerned about themselves, how selfish they are, and themselves, maybe not even their families. And ultimately, when it comes to anti-whites, you know, when they talk about things like, well, we need to bring all these refugees into the country, they like to play like they're on the moral high ground. But in reality, you can take the fight to them by pointing out how selfish they are, because they're not personally paying for these people. It's very unlikely that it's going to be them or one of their loved ones that is blown up or raped or murdered by one of these people coming in. So it is an extraordinarily selfish act, not to mention that they have no right, especially like in America where we have this hyper-individualism. These people have no right whatsoever. They've come up with nothing. They've inherited everything, all of the glory of the West, not to mention, you know, the blood running through their veins that gives them the intelligence and the abilities and the instincts that they have. But the language, the mathematics, they invented nothing. They inherited all of it. And so they have no right to give that away and to let it be destroyed or changed or altered to suit someone else's, some other group of people's interest. And that's ultimately just not to ramble on, but that's ultimately what happens when we bring in these foreign peoples. It's not so much the big damage that is done is not so much the blowing our people up and running them over with trucks, which they do, raping our people, which they do. That's not it. The big damage is that when they are in sufficient numbers, they manifest and project their biospirits, their instincts, onto our environment. And as our environment increasingly reflects their instinct, it becomes uncomfortable for us. And as an environment becomes uncomfortable for people, it also becomes dangerous. And where you have scenarios where you have several, at least two groups of people, and they all have what I refer to as numerical courage, they're all expressing their biospirits on their environments, you end up with essentially a cultural arms race, and then bloodshed and warfare. So that's the future that awaits. So even if they didn't commit the crimes, the rapes, the murders, and everything, they will never feel comfortable in our countries, because our countries don't reflect their biospirits, and we will never feel comfortable in what they project. And so there's always going to be that disharmony. This whole notion that diversity is a strength is just a magnification of divide and conquer. And the people who are
it's absolute nonsense, and it's nonsense for a start, but also it betrays a total lack of respect. It's a very frivolous attitude to the act of being a human. To suggest that, I mean, because it basically reduces all culture and behavior, ancestry, identity to just entertainment, just different sensations. You know, this is why I go on about the incredible range of restaurants. They always say, well, diversity is great because we have all these different restaurants to go to. And right. That is so shallow. It's so shallow and selfish as well.
That's what it is. And yeah, point that out every time, how selfish it is. You anti-white, you want to be able to have a kebab at a kebab shop so badly and so important to you that you're okay with Rotherham. You know, you're okay with all of these horrible things happening. The blood is on your hands. These things are happening because of your desires and satisfying your wishes. And not to mention that we don't need genuine Arabs making our kebabs. You know, we don't need genuine Hispanics, Mexicans making our burritos. We can have the variety in food, and we would have the variety in foods without these people. This type of there was a market for ethnic food, and it burgeoned in the West, And it would have been satisfied whether or not non-whites were present to fill those roles. I mean, we could very easily have the Swedish women feeding us kebabs if that's what we wanted. And they would take...
probably better, to be honest.
I'm sure of it.
Yeah. Well, I think it would be interesting to end on the following. What would you say to people who said, what is the white race?
What is the white race? Like they're challenging that we exist?
Well, if people on our own side were losing faith, what would you say that they were fighting for?
They're losing faith and they want to know what we're fighting for. Well, we are fighting for the greatest people. And we can say this subjectively, just like we can have subjective faith and belief in our sports teams. There's no way to necessarily objectively compare the races. We can subjectively say that Western kind is our people. It's our family. It's our loved ones. It's a chain that stretches back millennia through history that we are responsible for. It's a chain that will stretch forward for millennia to come if we do our duty. It is imperative now that we fight for white well-being, because if we do and we succeed, there'll be more Shakespeare's, there'll be more Max Planck's, there'll be more Beethoven's, and they will do great things because we have done something great. So now is the time for hope. Now is the time for courage. We are growing like we have never grown in the past. And there's, what's the Shakespeare? There is a tide in the affairs of men, which taken at the flood leads on to fortune. Omitted in all the voyage of their life is bound in shallows and in miseries. On such a full sea are we now afloat, and we must take the courage when it serves or lose our ventures. And so that's what we should be fighting for.
That's fantastic. No White Guilt, thank you very much for appearing on Millennial. I think this has been probably the best one so far. I hope you'll appear on the channel again.
Happily. I appreciate you bringing me into the conversation, and I encourage your audience again to show your appreciation by filling this man's belly with a bowl of warm soup. Make that donation.
Thank you, and support No White Guilt in any way you can as well. And don't forget about his Ask FM page, which I'll link again below in the text chat there. If you have any questions that you'd like to ask him, I'm sure he'd be willing to answer them. And hopefully it will help him to develop his channel. So, okay, well, that's it then. One further question. Somebody asked at the beginning, what microphone are you using? Because it sounds very good.
Let me see. It's called MXL 990 USB. That's what it says on the front of it. I bought it a couple years ago.
Okay. All right. Excellent. Thanks very much. And I'll be back tomorrow night with another four hangouts. So see you then. Once again, thank you, No White Guilt.
Okay. Thank you.
And good night.